I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More than half of us will not have enough savings when we retire to maintain our current standard of living, and we'll have to make substantial spending cuts once we stop working. Why is that so, and what might we do to change that? Our guest this hour is Professor Christian Weller, Professor of Public Policy at the University of Massachusetts in Boston and Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. He has published many articles, and his writings include publications of the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, USA Today, Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's testified before Congress on retirement issues and middle-class economic security. We'll be welcoming phone calls because here's an issue that affects all of us. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And we thank you very much, Christian Weller, for being with us. Hi.
Thank you very much for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, good to have you here. So the big question, of course, is why are there so many people who are going to find it very hard to save for retire and for retirement and thus to retire?
Well, let me first say, the number has actually grown over the course of a decade. We used to have about 30% of households, working-age households, who could expect to make substantial cuts in retirement. Now we're up to 50%.
Wow.
We're looking at a wave of people, and when we talk these percentages, we cannot overlook that the share of older people in our society is growing rapidly. Mm-hmm. It's actually the fastest growing population segment. So we're laying a problem on top of a problem. Why are we in this situation? I argue, and I should add, I have a new book out called Retirement on the Rocks, in which I lay out the case that this is not the problem of people not doing enough on their own. It is a problem of ill-designed policies that we've basically ignored economic realities for America's middle class for the last 30 years, and that has meant that people couldn't save enough for retirement. What I mean is the economic reality for us has been ever more unstable, less stable labor markets. Jobs have become less stable, unemployment has become longer, wages have been flat and often declining, benefits have been disappearing, and at the same time, the stock market and the housing markets have gone through these enormous boom and bust cycles. And all of that together has made it harder to save, especially since from a policy perspective, we've expected individuals to manage all of these enormous risks on their own. In the past, we had Social Security. We reduced some of that. We had defined benefit pension for many, so the traditional pensions, both in the public sector and the private sector. We've reduced some of that. And then we said, okay, well, now the seas have gotten rougher. Try to sink or swim on your own.
Mm-hmm.
With a 401k or an IRA or whatever other retirement savings account we have. And that just simply, at this point, we can clearly say that didn't work. And that's sort of the primary reason why people have fallen behind.
And I would imagine there are a whole lot of people who are not making enough money because of what's happened with wages. They just haven't gone anywhere for 15 years, if not more than that. So how can you possibly put aside anything for retirement when you're just trying to pay your bills?
They're sort of a mixed bag. We do know that even lower-income people can save under the right circumstances. It's just that the circumstances are wrong, and there's two things here. The first one is, if you're middle-income or lower-income, you look around and see, this has just gotten really risky. The job, chance of me losing my job or my spouse losing my job has gone up. Things can go awfully wrong. I may not be able to sell my house very quickly. So, I'd rather hold off on saving for retirement. That's one thing. The other part is, and hold on the cash just in case something goes wrong, but the other part is that in the past, people typically had some help from the employers. They had a pension or retirement savings plans. Employers have gradually mm-hmm. withdrawn from that. There's fewer employers now than there were 15 years ago who offer a retirement plan, and even those who offer pay less for their employees to contribute than they did in the 80s and 90s. So the system that we've built that relies heavily on employers to offer retirement plans just simply isn't working. Employers are becoming more and more reluctant to offer retirement benefits. And what that means is if you want to save for retirement, for most people that means not a 401k through an employer or a traditional pension. It means the individual retirement account, an IRA. And that is an incredibly complex and often costly and very risky mess.
Mm-hmm. When you say, Christian, that the complexity here confuses people and keeps them from saving enough or saving at all, you also talk about the efforts to protect those savings that people have from increasingly volatile market swings, and those protections have fallen on the back burner. Can you describe that more? What's happened with once protections we no longer have?
Well, the main protections we used to have is Social Security and defined benefit pensions. So Social Security, under the law, we've instituted a higher retirement age that started to take hold in 2000. So since 2000, the retirement age at which you can get full Social Security benefits has been going up from 65 to now. It's going to approach in the next few years 67. So that's an across-the-board cut from Social Security, and Social Security is actually not tied in with what's happening in the labor market or the stock market. So that risk protection is going away. Defined benefit pensions, and especially the private sector, have been cut back very substantially. But what we've had instead is these individual retirement savings accounts, and we basically said, like, well, you figure it out. We said, like, you can save on your own, and you figure out how to manage your risk, and that's just like asking people to do brain surgery while they're doing their day job. And what I'm saying is we need to make sure that we institute policies and incentives so that people can actually protect those assets, so that they can be sure that the money is there when they want to retire. Because right now, I think a lot of people, and we know this, anecdotally, but also from survey data, a lot of people simply say, like, look, why should I save any money? The next stock market crash is going to destroy it, take it away anyway. And that's sort of holding back people. But there's different things you can do. You could sort of disclose risk and say, like, this is a really risky product. Are you sure you want to have that? Or you want to invest here, that's safer. You can sort of steer sort of automatically built risk protections into 401ks and IRAs so that people actually can see that while the market is going up and down, their own retirement balance isn't. There are things you can do, and you can do them relatively cheaply in states, I should say, like states in particular, are beginning, Illinois is one example, for instance, are beginning to move in the direction to help people save more for retirement, but do so in a low-cost and low-risk way.
Hmm. So Illinois is doing, you mean for state workers or Illinois?
No, the idea is actually number of states. Illinois is one. California is another. They're sort of furthest along for private sector workers to basically fill the gap that the employers have left.
Hmm. What are they doing?
So the idea, the reason why we always talk about Illinois and California is because they're sort of the bookends of proposals. The Illinois approach would basically require that every employer has to at least offer a payroll deduction into an individual retirement account. The state then would regulate these accounts to make sure that they're low cost, would also make sure that the products are relatively low risk. California would go a step further. It would actually say, okay, well, you have to offer payroll deduction, and you can put it into a big pool of money that is already low cost, low risk. The state would manage the money, would contract it out to somebody who knows what they're doing. But that sort of, and the state would also encourage, would set sort of a benchmark contribution of how much employers had to contribute for their employees.
Oh, that's interesting.
How much to take out of the employee's paycheck. The employers cannot be, under state law, cannot be and compelled to put anything in for their employees.
Uh-huh. And when you talk about protections, and this is on everybody's mind because of 2008, certainly, it's fresh on our minds,
right.
Protections against market swings. Is it hard to do that, to protect yourself against the swing in the stock market?
It is very difficult to do. There are some things you can do. The main thing is there's basically basic financial economics, we say, is diversification. So you always want to sort of balance your money between stocks and bonds. The problem is that if you leave it to people individually to make this decision, people don't do it. They just forget about it because they have other things to worry about in their lives. So they're sort of new financial products. They sometimes called target date funds. Sometimes they're called model portfolios. But that's sort of what more and more people are doing. The other part is you regularly contribute, that you have sort of always, when the market crashes, you buy actually cheap. Again, there's sort of things you can automate to do savings. I would argue to go further than that and say we want to have more savings incentives and more tax incentives and more tax help to those people who are most likely to experience economic shocks in their lives, mm-hmm. Lower income people in particular. That means we need to redesign the tax incentives that we have so that we can give people extra help. You can probably go further, and I didn't explore that in my book, but you could probably add unemployment insurance reform to the mix as well.
Hmm. Do we have a lot of tax incentives for saving or just a minuscule number?
We spend oodles of money on savings incentives, but people don't really see that. So the main point is, before I go into the details, is the government already helps people to save, but it does so in a really, really bad way. The government has... There's two big buckets, and they're well over $100 billion a year in terms of money that the federal government loses to help people save. One big bucket is retirement savings, and the other one is housing. People don't really think about housing until they're sort of pushed as a savings form, but it is a form of savings. So let's take housing out and talk about retirement savings. The way the federal government does this, most commonly in the 401k or the IRA world, is those contributions are not subject to income taxation. So the federal government is foregoing money, income that it's owed, income taxes that it's owed, by saying, okay, well, if you put the money in a 401k or an IRA, I'm not going to take taxes out, federal income taxes on those. And many states that have state income taxes follow suit. They also say, like, we're not going to take state income taxes out if you do that. So that's a tax break that people get. And then while you're putting the money in a 401k or IRA, and while it's building up and while it's earning interest and capital gains, that money is also not subject to income to taxation.
Mm-hmm.
So those two things together, that contribution help and that extra help on the tax-free buildup, as we call it, that amounts to about $120, $130 billion a year right now. And as I said, states, the only estimate I'm aware of is it's about $20 billion that states lose by following the lead of the federal government. So altogether, you're talking well over $150 billion a year just to help people save for retirement. But the vast majority of that money goes to high-income earners, people who have a lot of money and who work for an employer that offers a retirement benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But the least money goes to people who are low-income earners who have basically pay a lot of income, pay a lot of taxes for Social Security and Medicare, but who don't pay much in terms of federal income taxes. They virtually get nothing from this. If they work for an employer that doesn't offer a 401k, they get very little. So the point is the system is what we call upside down. We sort of give the biggest help to the people who arguably need the least help, and we give the least help to the people who need the most help. And a number of researchers, myself included, have argued, let's just do away with it. Just take these deductions, turn them into one credit, and give everybody, for every dollar that they put in, the same amount, for instance. So every dollar you get 20 cents from the government as a match, and regardless of how much income you have, and that would be a much more efficient and more equitable system than what we have now.
We're going to go to phone calls in just a moment. Christian Weller is our guest. He's the author of Retirement on the Rocks. He's a professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. And we're talking about why it is that so many of us are struggling to save money for retirement and what can be done about it? Here's our phone number. We have one line open right now, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now. Dan in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you? Actually, I have been a longtime listener of NPR, but a short-time listener to your show, and I'm really happy to be on.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, so I have learned a lot so far, from the guests that you have on, but I would have to say, as a 25-year-old, fresh out of a graduate program, working in my first job, I think in the future it's going to be even worse because us, we're crippled with student loan debt.
Yeah.
So the hard part for us is how do we not only try to pay off our debt as quickly as possible, because quite honestly, with interest, it's smart for me to try to pay it off as soon as possible. But how do I take advantage of some saving for retirement when all my income has to go out the door and pay for my college?
Oh, it's rough, isn't it? Good question. Christian?
Well, there's two answers to this one. The first one is sort of like very economic-y argument. If you pay down your debt, you're actually saving. So people sort of misinterpret that. Reducing your debt actually helps. But it's the same as you would put the money into a savings account. But that's sort of like the textbook answer. The non-textbook answer, the real-life answer, if you will, is it is indeed problematic because people sort of, as the caller said, as Dan said, he's focused very much right now, at least on the financial side, on paying down the debt and doesn't think about the other things. And that's one of the big, on retirement savings or saving for a house or saving for the future somewhere else. And that's exactly one of the big problems. We have set up this world where the government is incentivizing savings for housing, savings for retirement, and there's 12 different retirement savings forms, for instance. We have then also a number of healthcare savings forms, and we help people save for education and through a different number of different things. And then there's a bunch of other things we do. You can save, for instance, for parking and transportation. We all do this through the tax code, but the problem is by stovepiping this, by saying, okay, well, today we're going to talk about saving for healthcare, tomorrow about housing, and then the day after for retirement. In between, we talk about repaying your student loans. We make the system unnecessarily complex, confuse people, and that complexity actually stands in the way of people's ability to save. So what I've argued, what a number of people have argued, is let's make this a lot simpler. Let's have one form of one retirement saving and one non-retirement saving, and let's be done with it. Let's not call things, let's not unnecessarily complicate us. People's lives are unnecessarily complicated already, and policy shouldn't make saving for the future even more complicated.
Hmm. Dan, all the best to you as you carry on here with your life. It's an exciting time. Thanks, Dan, for your call. Robert in Sun Prairie. Hi.
Hi. In searching in such as Google, type Phoenix 7, FINNICS, number 7, .blogspot. Robert Rubin and Bill Clinton are the world's most evil things by killing USA through killing the Glass-Steagall Bank Control Act, which allowed the banks to get into the derivatives, the freedom up to start playing in the derivatives market. The killing resulted in mega billionaires and tottering economics worldwide and forcing middle class to join the poor class. No middle class left. When I went to a private college, it cost me only $900 a year for room and board and tuition. That was in the 50s and 60s. Look what we've got now.
Professor Weller.
Well, it's very difficult to figure out why all the policies that have gone into making both the labor market and the stock markets less stable. But one thing I would add is, we're not the only country that goes through this. The hollowing out of the middle class is sort of a phenomenon we see in other countries to some degree. including Central Europe, Western Europe, Germany, France, but also particularly the United Kingdom. So, but we're living with these trends, and to some degree, I sometimes wear a hat as a macroeconomist, and I have some answers on what we should do about rebuilding the middle class through some macro policies, but that's not the discussion today. What I'm arguing is that we have made a bad situation, the labor market uncertainty and the stock market and housing market uncertainty, even worse through policy inattention. We can actually redesign policies, and there's a lot of bipartisan support for redesigning policies to help people get out of this hole so that that their current uncertainty doesn't necessarily translate into insecurity and poverty in retirement. The one thing is to really redo the tax code. And as I said, like, there's bipartisan support to start better using the tax code to help low-income people, moderate-income people, to save more for the future than rather giving away the store to rich people.
All right, so let's go next to Sherry in Middleton. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. My comment actually goes to something that the guest said a bit ago, and that was about 2008 and about the swings in the stock market. And it just struck me as a strange comment because, yes, there was a swing in the stock market, but it was directly related to the banking entities playing a shell game with money, mm-hmm. and using instruments that were not being given the proper oversight. It wasn't an accident if the safeguards had been followed and the new ones that are proposed were put in place. We wouldn't have a swing that is because of greed. So I just wanted to point that out. And also, I'm wondering how much of the value of our stock market has been recovered since 2008. The comments I'm hearing is that our stock market is not healthy, and that's not my impression.
Well, there's a lot of things here. The first one is we need to take a step back. While I agree that the crisis certainly we can lay clear blame to lack of oversight and missed incentives in the financial industry, we've had large both stock market and housing and labor market swings since the early 1980s. Sort of the early 1980s, then the housing market is clear, so 1983 sort of starts taking off, and we go through these boom and bust cycles. The housing market, we've had sort of ever larger housing booms. Think about sort of late 1980s, Texas and Massachusetts go under with the SNL crisis, but that sort of repeats itself, and that sort of those are clear clear breaks, and so this is a 30-year trend we've had. But by and large, the final question that I would say, like, what is more worrisome than the Great Recession, when the government actually was forced to step in and help people out through a number of measures, is sort of these swings that lead to more mild recessions or just to losses of wealth, especially in the housing market, because a lot more household wealth is tied up in housing, and more people have housing wealth than stock market wealth. The majority of Americans don't really own stocks. So what happens in the stock market is sort of nifty for people to look at, but by and large, unless it tanks the economy, it doesn't really affect most people. But what happens in the housing market, what happens in the job market, those things do affect most middle-class Americans, and those are much more worrisome to me from a policy perspective. And that's sort of where we've basically let people say, like, okay, well, we know the labor market has become more insecure. We know the housing market has become less secure, and yet we ask you to manage more of that volatility by yourself.
Mm. Do you think that people, even of modest means, should learn something about the stock market and take, I don't know, a 10-year period in their lives if they have it, and invest something?
I don't know. That depends on your own personal risk preferences. I think people should learn something about finances and sort of become educated about some of the financial measures. But I also should say, like, I'm an economist. I'm trained as a banker, and I like this stuff. I know nothing about car repairs, and I probably should learn something about car repairs. But there's just not enough time we should be mindful that asking people to learn more about the basics of daily life might be good, but we shouldn't pin our hopes that that sort of solves our retirement crisis. I mean, saving for retirement and investing for retirement is fairly complicated stuff. There's sort of this
yes.
anecdote that about 50% of most economists who study this stuff basically don't make their own decisions. They just give it to either, like, they basically check one box on their retirement savings plan and say, like, yeah, like, the plan knows what's best for me, and leave it alone. They don't try to do this themselves either, and they study it professionally. So the main point is that saving for retirement and investing for retirement for the long term is very complex stuff, especially in a world that is marked by incredible uncertainty in the labor market, the stock market, the housing market. And what policy needs to do is give up on this idea that we can educate people to do this better by themselves, but rather give them the tools and make it as easy for them to do things that will protect their savings over the long term.
Sherry, thanks for your call. Jacob in Appleton. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. So I've been a long-time listener of public radio, and one of the things I like about public radio is that it highlights ideas that come from Wisconsin that kind of are working to produce solutions like your guest is talking about right now. And there's a sponsor up in Northeast Wisconsin of public radio, and they launched something called Wisconsin Select, and it's kind of neat because it's a 401k platform that actually moves dollars away from Boston and New York and Chicago and the big money centers, because it's comprised exclusively of Wisconsin providers. And I wonder if the guests can talk a little bit about, just having, local responsibility and more local decision-making, as opposed to, Wisconsin sends, I think, something like $290 billion of retirement plan assets, and most of that gets sent out of state to your guest's backyard, like Boston, which, the guest Rob a second ago talked about the volatility in these right. big firms. So if you could talk a little bit about that, that'd be great.
I do have mixed feelings about this. I have been to Wisconsin a few times and certainly have a certain affinity for the state. But investing in your home state is, from a purely risk-managed perspective, often probably not a good idea. This is sort of the problem that we run. Think about, in an extreme case, the Enron example, where you work for a company and all your retirement money is invested with a company. If the company goes under, you not only lose your job, but you're also losing your future. To some extreme, that is also happening if you work in Wisconsin and then you save money and you invest all your money in Wisconsin. Or think about more regionally, you work in the auto industry and all your money is invested in Detroit. If there's a shock to the economy of Wisconsin, or if there's a shock to the economy in Detroit, you're not only losing your job, your earnings, your spouse will probably lose their job too, or lose some earnings, and your retirement savings goes down at the same time. If you're working in a certain place, you actually want to put the money as far away as possible so you can diversify some of these risks. I understand there's always this sort of, because it seems to make intuitive sense, this willingness to say, like, we need to invest the money in our local economy. But that just makes something that's risky even riskier, and doesn't mean you need to send the money to New York, to Boston, to China, or wherever. But it probably means you shouldn't necessarily invest it at home. But that's where I fall down. I know there's people who think differently, but that's generally my sense.
All right. Thanks, Jacob. Matt in Viroqua. Hi.
Hi there. Kind of a two-part comment. The first part is, you just mentioned that the savings incentive program is upside down. I'd argue that's because we no longer – I'm a capitalist. I believe in free market capitalism. We no longer have free market capitalism in this country. We have an oligarchy, or, if you would, cronyism, I suppose you could say. The wealthy have lobbyists to get laws passed that benefit them and their savings, and the poor don't. So I would say that's probably why we have an upside-down savings incentive program. Secondly, I'd like to ask your guest how he would feel about simplifying the entire tax code, just reforming the tax code top to bottom and making it something much simpler than it is now. Perhaps do away with income tax and institute a sales tax only type of tax in the economy or something to that effect.
I'm in favor of simplifying the tax code, although I wouldn't necessarily subscribe to the ideas that were thrown out there. Let me give you the example of what I've proposed on the savings side. I've argued that it makes very little sense for the government to tell people, well, you can save only $5,500 for retirement if you have access to an IRA. You can save for retirement $18,000 if your employer, or $18,500 if your employer offers a 401k. And then you can save another $2,000, $3,000 for health care, and you can save, if your state allows it, to save some money for education. The government, state or federal government, shouldn't tell people how much and where and when they can save for their future. People know their own needs better. So what I've argued is, and as I said, I'm not the only one, we should take all of these savings incentives and put them all in one thing so that people can put their money and say, like, I'm going to save for the future, and then I'll decide as a saver when I'm going to use it. Is it an emergency? Like people said, my kid's education, for a house, or for retirement. That raises the question, should the government help people to save for the future? Or should we just leave them basically say, like, it's a good thing to save for the future, but you're on your own? And the evidence from psychology basically says that people do need some help, that without sort of economic incentives, some regulatory help, people will not save enough for the future, largely because they're so focused on the here and now. They're focused on the present, to paying their bills. And that's particularly true in a world where jobs have become very unstable. So in a world where things have become unstable in the day-to-day, the government's role and the need for government to help people, give them the incentives, the regulatory help to save for the future is actually greater, which is we just need to do it better than we have. The way we're doing right now is incredibly complex and very inefficient. It gives, again, the most help to those who need it the least.
What grade do you give it?
The current retirement savings system deserves an F.
An F?
Yeah, there's very, it's overly complex. As I said, there's 12 different retirement savings programs. The bulk of retirement savings incentives goes to the top 20% of earners who really don't need it. The evidence says that out of the $120 billion we spend, about $90 billion is just simply helping rich people to shift money from non-tax-advantaged to tax-advantaged savings so they don't actually save more money. Put another way, for every $100 we spend in tax incentives, we get one extra dollar in savings. There's very little in the tax code that's less efficient. Mm-hmm. Maybe giving oil companies a credit for oil exploration is less efficient. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that we have in a tax code to help low-income people, it's called the Savers Credit, is, again, so poorly designed that most poor people can't take advantage of it. They're disqualified from it. The way we do this for the tax code in particular is, I don't think there are some people who think it works well. It's incredibly complex and inefficient, and from a policy design perspective, poorly done.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Matt. George in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was thinking about that, you know, the decline of unions, the effect that it has on people's retirement, because back when there were more unions, people had pensions, and even non-unions were kind of forced to offer pensions to attract people to work for them. Do you agree with that?
Sort of. The What unions did is they really, and we do see this still, where unions are present, we still have pensions, traditional pensions. Pensions tend to take a lot of the offer a lot of protections, for instance, protections from the stock market swings. They also offer some protections from labor market risk. But there are things that pensions don't do all that well. It's not the fault of the unions. It's just something that pensions don't do. In order to qualify for a pension, often you have to work for an employer for a long time, typically 5 years, sometimes longer. So if you leave before then, you get very little or nothing. So that's certainly one shortcoming. And you got to remember, even at sort of the heyday, about 40% of private sector workers had a pension, meaning 60% of private sector workers didn't have them. People who worked for small employers didn't have them. Because it sort of shifts the logic the other way around. If you're a small manufacturer in the middle of Wisconsin, you're making car parts or you're processing wood and paper, and you don't want to deal with figuring out how to hire a financial manager. It's not a regulatory issue. It's sort of like you're running a manufacturing business. You're not running a financial business. And most employers, many employers, didn't offer pensions even when unions were more prevalent. So bringing back pensions would address some of the insecurity problems. It would sort of make retirement savings more stable, but it wouldn't necessarily give more access to people who don't have retirement savings at this point.
Thanks, George. Tom, Fond du Lac, hi.
Hi. I have a couple of comments to make and a question. We are a small employer in this area, about 40 employees. And for many years, we gave a bonus at the end of the year. At the end of our year, if we had a profit, we gave a bonus which equaled about 2 to 4% of the employees' wages. Mm. And we put that into a 401k. And we would have somebody from the organization who managed the 401k come in and coach the people on what to do with the money. But individuals who never put any of their own money in looked at the money we put in and said, you really haven't given us anything if we can't spend that money now. It's our money, and you have no right to keep it or take it. You should give it to us in a check. So my question is, isn't it the problem that people have the concept of immediate gratification, that group that has very little savings set aside for the future because the only thing they can see is what they want to buy today or tomorrow? And isn't that a problem that we're dealing with today, that short-sightedness doesn't want to move that on?
It's certainly a problem, what you call short-sightedness or instant gratification. It hasn't changed over time. It's always been part of human nature. There is another issue here, another nice psychological issue. It's called inertia. And so if we change the code, the tax code, and you gave the money into a 401k, and we said, like, well, come back tomorrow and you can take it out, you would see that the vast majority of people wouldn't actually do it because the money is already sitting in a 401k. They're like, well, I'll get to it when I get to it, when I need to buy a boat or when I need to renovate my house or something like that. And then they forget about it. They leave it there and stays there for retirement. And so telling people, and we know this from academic studies, I did some study on this too, that telling people, like, look, you can put your money in 401k, and when you need it, you can borrow from your 401k for a house, for a car, for emergencies, and then you pay yourself back over the next 5 to 10 years with your own contributions to your 401k. That actually increases people's willingness to save money. In the end, most people don't ever take that loan. When they take a loan, they take relatively small amounts. By creating this artificial distinction between this is a retirement dollar and this is a spending dollar through the tax code, we actually stand from a policy perspective in the way of people's People saving, because people say, like, well, I don't really want to squirrel this dollar away for the next 50 years. I might need it tomorrow. And so what we've learned is giving people the sense of flexibility that they can access the money when they want it and when they need it will actually increase their willingness to save and put their own money into the savings.
I wonder if you've studied any international economies to find out if there are places where retirement isn't as difficult, that people have been saving and the government has helped out.
We do know that these human psychology traits are common, at least for most industrialized
everywhere.
Countries.
Mm-hmm.
The United States is, I wouldn't say unique, but when you sort of think United States versus Canada and Western Europe, our Social Security, let me back up. The social welfare state we have in the United States is, writ large, about as large as it is in Europe. But that seems surprising to people. But the way we do social policy and social welfare, like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, savings for retirement, health insurance, is quite different. The way we do it here is we sort of have the government provide a very basic benefit, Social Security and Medicare, and then we give a lot of tax incentives for people to do it on their own. In Europe, it's all done through, like, Social Security and Medicare-like programs are much larger, and the tax incentives are much smaller. So that's the main thing. So it's a design of policy, both for retirement and for health care. The U.S. government does as much as the Western European countries do, but I would argue in many ways it does it a lot much less efficiently and is wasting a lot of money.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about retirement this hour and why it is that many are struggling to save money for retirement and what policies need to be put in place that would, make the money stable, people being helped with reduction to risky assets, what the identifiable policy shortcomings are here in the United States, what's going on with Social Security, and what it is we can do. Here's the general statement here that more than half of us won't have enough savings when we retire to maintain our current standard of living, and we'll have to make substantial spending cuts once we stop working, which nobody wants to see happen. So what do we do about it? Our guest this hour is Professor Christian Weller. He is a professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, author of Retirement on the Rocks. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to more phone calls now. Chris in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I'm a financial advisor at a firm up here in Wausau, and I have clients that were investing in 2008 and long before that, but I used a lot of funds that were actually from Boston, companies like Fidelity and MFS and a bunch of those. One of your other guests talked about just how volatile those were, and they really, really were. And one of the other guests talked about investing in Wisconsin. There are actually a lot of managers right here in Wisconsin that are top rated, and I'm wondering, if the guest can talk a little bit about using managers that are in Wisconsin versus in Massachusetts or New York or someplace else.
I really don't know. It depends on the financial product lineup. Part of it is that I don't mean to say negative things about the management industry, but it's difficult to persistently outguess the market, and I doubt that that's different by region to region. The one thing I should say, though, is that some financial product development, financial service companies, but also managers are beginning to really pay greater attention to the protection of assets. So there's more use of hedging strategies to make sure that people's assets are protected and still generate some reasonable amount of return. The problem is at this point, especially if you do it at a smaller scale, it can be fairly costly. But again, the financial service industry is thinking in that direction, that how can we make sure that people not only earn money with their savings, but that those savings will be there when people need them.
Thanks, Chris. Kenneth in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. Nothing has been said about Maslow's hierarchy of needs being met here. I mean, if people were comfortable with having, you know, their needs met at the basic level, food, housing, they would take care of the future, be more than likely. And nothing has been said about that. I mean, that's part of the big part of the problem now.
Professor Willer.
I think there's two things. The first one is we sort of have, we struggle with what it actually means to have basic needs covered. And as economists, we still look at this. So, yes, it means probably not going hungry, but when it things comes to housing and healthcare, the cost of that go up. Yes, I could theoretically live and easily afford a house from the 1970s, except those don't exist anymore. Think about health insurance plans. It's easy to pay for a health insurance plan from the 1960s, except nobody will offer that. And so the costs have gone up for many of the basic services that people need. And so that's one thing, and wages often haven't kept pace with this. The second part is even when people have their basic needs met, there is a psychological problem. We really have to realize, both as economists as well as business folks, that human psychology can stand in the way of people making savings decisions. Most people want to save. They just are so busy with other things in their lives that they forget about it. They're like, I'll get to that this weekend after I mow the lawn and take the kids to the doctors and all of that stuff, and then I'll set up a 401k and put money away. And that's where policy comes in, to overcome that inertia, to make it easy for people to save. And right now we're not making it easy for people to save.
Thanks very much, Kenneth, for your call. And Mark in Richland Center, hi.
This whole question of savings makes absolutely no sense if the dollar itself, by the time you pull it out of savings, will have less purchasing power than the day that you put it in. The dollar has lost 95% of its purchasing power since 1913. When you add to that all the problems that we've already talked about of the swings in the market and the evil of the bankers and all of that, the insanity of this question about whether or not a person should save, it's not even a sensible argument to say that people should do so when to do so is actually going to be a losing proposition. And this is really not a savings question. It's a monetary question. Why do we allow banks to create money at interest when the interest itself is what's driving the losing in the monetary system? We're all losing because money is created at interest, and it's just a stupid system.
Professor.
Well, savings is one side of the monetary system. Credit is the other side, and we do need credit for people, for the economy to work. But the main point, and it's certainly worrisome in the last few years, is that what people can earn often without taking too much risk is not enough to offset the loss of value from inflation. And that's a monetary policy issue. That's a fiscal policy problem. How do we get the economy growing again? How do we get to a point where people, when they save money, actually won't lose money, as the listener said? But that's sort of like has been a phenomenon only for the last few years. For the vast majority of the last 150 years, this hasn't been a problem. And I hope it won't be that much longer a problem, that we will get to a point that interest rates in what you can earn on the stock market and in the housing market on average will at least offset the loss on savings. It has to, because otherwise this whole savings and credit system will break down and will actually become harder for people to get credit, which is the flip side of savings.
Mm. Professor Weller, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest this hour, Professor Christian Weller. He is author of Retirement on the Rocks. He's a professor of public policy at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and he's also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. We thank KP Whaley for producing this hour and Kendra Smith for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Monday, it's all things political. Oh, it's all things political all the time these days. It's so wacky. We'll have a great guest with us. Jamel Bouie, I believe, is joining us on Monday. And then the second hour of our program today, you've probably heard about this book. It's received a whole lot of attention in Milwaukee. Matthew Desmond, who's the author of Evicted. It's a book on poverty. It focuses on the poorest neighborhoods of Milwaukee and the story of eight families who are on the edge. Very important. Book receiving critical acclaim, and that will be Monday at 2 o'clock. So we hope you'll join us for that. Thanks for listening today, and thanks for your calls. News is coming up until Monday. Thanks.